Hello and welcome to this edition of Viewpoints. I'm Boris Chassaigne. I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's show, the Quebec government introduces Bill 96 to protect the French language in the province, but opposition is growing. Many are worried about their fundamental rights.
The main concern is that the English language would be criminalized. Quebec language officials will have more power than our judicial system because Bill 96 overrides the Quebec and Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms.
We'll go to Halifax, where a university professor has mixed feelings about designating certain outdoor areas for shelter the homeless.
I think over the past few years, there's been a deeper understanding of some of the systemic and structural barriers. And I think once you start to explore those dynamics, deeper empathy and deeper advocacy emerge.
And Mike Moore, a Cortes Island naturalist and professional diver, is heading up an effort in Cortes Bay to monitor Dungeness crab larvae as part of a study assessing the health of the Pacific Ocean.
At this time of year, when I was doing moorings, the crabs would literally be exploding out of the sand as I dragged a chain across. And now I don't see even very much shell out there.
Welcome to Viewpoints.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
So we make our first stop in the province of Quebec, where concerns are growing over the provincial government's Bill 96 new language law, which could be adopted in Quebec's National Assembly as soon as May 24th. The bill was tabled a year ago to promote and protect the French language through the introduction of various regulations such as capping admissions in English CEGEPs and limiting communication in English in government services. The government says the bill reinforces the status of French in all spheres of society and modifies the Charter of the French Language, also known as Bill 101, adopted in 1977 under the René Lévesque government. But many say the projected law will be impacting the rights and freedoms of both English speakers as well as the entire population. No one will be able to challenge the law in court. The government has once again preemptively invoked the notwithstanding clause, as it recently did for Bill 21 that prohibits state employees such as prosecutors, police officers, and teachers from wearing religious symbols. The Townshipers Association is an organization that supports and promotes the interest of English-speaking Quebecers in the eastern townships that's close to the U.S. border. And as many recently did, the association held a demonstration at Massévanie High School alongside of its students and staff to address Bill 96. More than 300 students and staff members signed a petition delivered to their National Assembly MNA. Others sent letters to the Legault government protesting against Bill 96. It all comes down to a concern of the English language being criminalized, says Nikki Moore, working with the Network Partnership Initiative for Townshipers. Quebec language officials, she says, will have more power than our judicial system because Bill 96 overrides the Quebec and Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, says Moore. Under Bill 96, English speakers will have to prove that they are historical Anglophones if they want to communicate in their language or they can be fined. Journalist Taylor McClure interviews Nikki Moore.
The main concern is that the English language would be criminalized. So Quebec language officials will have more power than our judicial system because Bill 96 overrides the Quebec and Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. So once you've been fined for speaking English to someone who does not have proof that they're a historical Anglophone, you have no legal recourse and you just have to pay up. So just to give you a little context, you know, we need justification for a warrant if someone is murdered. And then you need a warrant to seize confidential documents, electronic devices, personal cell phones, if someone's murdered, right? Which is a process that protects our freedom. But anyone, any anonymous call from anyone at all will give the language officials the right to seize your personal cell phone, confidential medical files, anything they want without a warrant. They can enter your place of work, your home, your hotel room, your car, and they can take your devices, again, without a warrant. All they need is one anonymous complaint that if someone suspects you might be communicating in English in the future, it doesn't even have to have happened already, then, you know, the powers that the language officials have are just enormous. And also these confidential reportings will be encouraged. So an increased surveillance and a decrease in privacy. And, you know, we're talking about a $700 to $90,000 fine if you're guilty of speaking English or communicating in English. And, you know, we had interest from our French-speaking students from Val d'Isère who came over to get some information and sign the document because it infringes on their right to choose to go to an English CEGEP, which is the first opportunity these students have to learn a second language. And it's a very difficult decision that they make because it is hard to learn in another language.
In regards to the bill that you're referring to Bill 96, you've already highlighted some of its details, but can you pinpoint other details as well, maybe related to the health and social services and more in the education aspect, and how this will impact the population, the English population, but as well as the French population in Quebec too?
Right. Yes, it does affect everyone for sure. I mean, I worked at the CLSC for years as a social worker, and I had amazing French-speaking colleagues who did their best to master the English language so that they could serve their English families and help them. It wasn't easy for them because, again, they didn't have access to learning English. Now what's going to happen is there's going to be such a problem because essentially if you're speaking to a service user in English, what you're going to have to do is make sure they have the proper documentation to prove they're historical Anglophone. If they do not have these documents, which are a great majority of English-speaking Quebecers will not have those documents, including our seniors and most vulnerable populations.
Are these historical documents like ancestry documents, basically?
Yeah,
like how far your English roots go back here in the province?
Well, exactly. So in other words, I can send my child to an English-speaking school. So she goes to Knowlton Academy, one of my daughters. And that's because I have the paperwork to prove that I'm a historical Anglophone. But, you know, I don't think my mom has that paperwork. You know, she's in her 70s and she can't get that paperwork because her parents are deceased. You know, do we have to carry these papers around? Will it be a waterproof bracelet? Some sort of tattoo. Now I'm being a little bit sarcastic, but how do we prove this status that people are allowed to speak to us in English? Because, as I said, my colleagues who would be, fighting to be able to increase their knowledge of English to better serve the English-speaking community, now they have to look over their shoulder and worry that there might be a complaint made anonymously and that, you know, the Office de Langue de Français could come in, seize confidential medical files. So that's including, you know, psychological files, social work files. This is highly confidential information. Nobody should have access to this. These are locked away for a good reason. Now, this would go against their code of ethics. So I'm really, really curious as to what the Professional Order of Social Workers and psychologists and, you know, medical health professionals as well, what these orders will have to say about this, because our code of ethics is that we serve our community, that we prioritize their health and safety, not the language that they speak, and also that we prioritize their confidentiality. So there's two elements that the professional orders will have a very big problem with.
There's another major concern here for English speakers in Quebec is the cap on access to education. Could you comment on that as well and what it implies within Bill 96?
Our CEGEPs at the moment will be frozen at the numbers that they are at right now. So there will be no growth in terms of providing more spots available to our youth who want to access these programs. the priority of those spots will go to English-speaking Anglophones with that historical documentation, and it will not go to them.
I wasn't sure if there were any other details in the bill itself that you would like to pinpoint that you think people should be aware of.
It touches on so many aspects of our lives. It really, I promise you that every single Quebecer will be negatively affected by this bill. I'm concerned because there's a labor shortage. If I'm an employer with my own company, if I hire someone who can speak English, what that's going to do is put the fear in me that that person might communicate in English. And then an anonymous tip might be made. And then my devices might be seized, including my personal cell phone, as well as my employee. And then that employee could be fined, and so could I. And as I said, the fines are very hefty, and there's no way around them because, again, of the notwithstanding clause, it supersedes the Quebec and Canadian Charter of Rights. Unfortunately, it looks like this bill will pass, but we can still fight this. An election is coming up, and we need to step up. We tend to allow these things to happen without doing anything about it. I know we're tired. I'm tired. There are so many other more creative, wonderful ways to protect our French language. We can all agree that's a priority. But I don't think it should supersede our right for privacy and our right to access healthcare. Please go get more information. This kind of thing just snuck up on us, and we need to be informed minimum. Once you're informed, I promise you, you will do something about this. So if you visit the QCGN, the Quebec Community Groups Network website, you can find a ton of info there. Also, look for them on YouTube. That was how I got a lot of my information. Many people have spent countless hours looking into Bill 96 and the implications on this province, and we really need to be more aware. You can also check out the task force website. Go to protectourrights.ca.
Many First Nation leaders feel that their efforts to rebuild their languages and cultures are in jeopardy with Bill 96. But Quebec says, as reported by the CBC, that it won't change Bill 96 to exempt Indigenous youth from having to take the extra French courses in CEGEP, despite the mounting criticism from First Nation leaders, such as Kakanawage Grand Chief Genesene Nawe, Sky Deer, Chief Ghislain Picard of the Assembly of First Nations, Quebec Labrador, and Geskapijia First Nation Chief John Martin. Quoted by the Canadian press, the minister responsible for the French language in Quebec and also Minister of Justice, Simon Jolin Barrette, has vigorously defended Bill 96 in the face of criticism. Quebec Prime Minister Legault has called it reasonable, balanced, and necessary to assure the adequate protection of the French language in the province.
Hi, I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, British Columbia. You are listening to Viewpoints.
To Halifax, Nova Scotia now, where Dr. Jeff Carabinow, a Dalhousie University professor with over 30 years of social work experience, declared he has mixed feelings regarding a Halifax Council staff report which endorses designating certain outdoor areas for sheltering. People experiencing homelessness will be able to shelter in 16 possible park spaces, most of them which are parks, according to the 24-page report. The Dalhousie University professor says that scripting new bylaws to let people sleep outside may not be the best solution. Mobilizing resources towards affordable housing may be far more productive. For the first time in Nova Scotia, we have all levels of government talking about different initiatives and approaches in an attempt to reduce the number of people on the streets, he says. Reporter Sarah Gouda is in Halifax, and she discusses sustainable homelessness strategies and misconceptions with Dr. Jeff Carabinow.
I have mixed feelings around, because I get it that affordable housing is very difficult these days, but we've been advocating for years and years, and there's some models out there around using you know, old buildings, using places that used to house employees for companies that are now sitting empty, that we could be really kind of pivoting to getting folks into some form of supportive, sustained living arrangement, as opposed to figuring out what's the best park that people can set up tents.
Carapino explained what he believes might serve as a better and more effective solution.
There are lots of available, you know, spaces that are empty right now that really we could pivot to develop into some form of housing. That, to me, would be a better option than figuring out what park is best to set up a tent.
He discusses what he believes are better interim styles of support that are more dignified.
If we're thinking about, you know, scripting new bylaws to let people sleep outside, why don't we find interim styles of support rather than that? Because, you know, it's still cold in the summer. You know, it's not a dignified way to support people who are really suffering right now.
To get a better understanding of the misconceptions regarding homelessness, we ask why the topic of homelessness generates some debate and confusion.
I think there's a variety of emotions that I think surface when somebody walks by someone who's homeless. One is, you know, a sense of empathy and sadness to the fact that these folks don't have the same supports and resources that others do. I think there's a bit of fear of the unknown, fear of, you know, particular possible violent interaction. I also think there's a lot of uncomfortableness because we feel a little bit of shame around the fact that some people are suffering while others aren't. So it's easier to kind of distract ourselves with sometimes stereotyping populations as the other that aren't worthy or don't deserve particular supports. I think over the past few years, there's been a deeper understanding of some of the systemic and structural barriers. And I think once you start to explore those dynamics, deeper empathy and deeper kind of advocacy emerge.
Carapino explained that there are systemic and structural barriers in place that make it difficult for people to afford homes.
So structural elements like poverty. A lot of these folks have had such harsh treatments in the child welfare systems. We know income assistance that a lot of folks are on just cannot support people financially. There's systemic barriers, race, gender dynamics, sexual orientation. You know, when we realize that, you know, over 40% of the population come from African Nova Scotian indigenous communities, while they represent only, you know, 1% of our entire Nova Scotian population, we know there's an issue there.
And in your experience, since you've been in this for 33 years, where were we and where are we going? So I want you to just tell me, over your 30 years, do you think we're getting worse? Are we doing better? What is the trajectory, I guess, for the next decade or so?
That's a really good question. I think in terms of intervention on the micro level, I think we're getting better. There used to be this idea that in the literature it's called treatment first approach, where you had to get fixed before you could get any type of housing. And homelessness is an issue of housing on a very basic level. We've moved, I think, globally now to accept the dynamic that we are exploring homelessness through a housing first and a trauma-informed lens, where, like I said earlier, you create a foundation, a stability, and then you can work on all the other dynamics at play here. And that makes a lot of sense. So I think we moved in that way. So I think we're much more compassion-focused in our interventions. There's been a lot more resources set up. There's more shelters. There's more Band-Aid approaches that are, I think, important for crises. And we have, in Nova Scotia, for the first time in a while that I remember, we have all levels of government that are speaking together and talking about different initiatives and approaches.
Cortes Island naturalist and professional diver Mike Moore is heading up an effort in Cortes Bay to monitor Dungeness crab larvae as part of a study assessing the health of the Pacific Ocean. The study is part of the Sentinels of Change project, organized by the Haikai Institute, a project supported by the Friends of Cortes Island Environmental Stewardship and Education Organization. Moore's monitoring station is situated on a dock in Cortes Bay, where every other day until August 31st, he pulls a light to trap out of the water. After emptying the catch into a white tub, he takes photographs and inspects the contents. Moore says Dungeness crab larvae are highly sensitive to changes in the ocean acidity, temperature, and salinity, and are one piece of data in a very complex system. Reporter Greg Osoba spent time at the docks with Mike Moore as he reveals the content of his latest catch.
What we're doing is we are counting the larval form of Dungeness crab. And I used to dive Hernando and Savory Island. And at this time of year, when I was doing moorings, the crabs would literally be exploding out of the sand as I dragged a chain across. And now I don't see even very much shell out there. And yes, there is not many Dungeness crabs. So Dungeness crabs are very vulnerable to ocean acidification. So that could be a problem. It could be that their larval forms are not surviving. It could be that the larval forms, the babies are not being produced. So this is just a data point. This particular project, all the light traps in the Salish Sea lit up on Good Friday, April 15th. And they will continue to fish every night until August 31st. And so that's the monitoring time span. And we check the traps every 2 days in the morning and just count and see what's in the traps.
A bit of a cliche, Mike, but is it fair to say that in a sense, these larvae or these young crabs are likened to the canary in the coal mine in terms of the ocean health?
They are a data point
okay. In
a big complex picture.
Okay.
That's it. But at the moment, we're going to go see now what we got today. But at the moment, we haven't come up with any Dungeness crab megalope. That's the larval form we're looking for. And it's still pretty early in the season. Myself, my own observations when I'm working down on Hernando Island, you see the Dungeness crabs come up into the sand flat shallows in late May, early June. And that's when they're mating and producing eggs. So we're still a little early, but we are finding all kinds of other interesting.
All right. Can you describe what we're doing, Mike?
Right now we're hauling up the light trap. And the light trap is essentially a 5-gallon pail that's attached to one of those commercial blue water jugs. The blue water jug has got 6 holes drilled into it, with funnels attached to those holes, with the neck going into the bucket so it forms a trap. And then the 5-gallon pail on the top is foamed, and it holds the electronics for the light. The light strip goes down into the clear blue water jug, so it'll track creatures at night. And then at the very end, bottom of the blue water jug, is basically just black PVC piping with holes drilled in and screen on the inside of that. So right now we're draining the water through those screens, and all the critters will be washing down into that bottom part of PVC pipe, and that's where we're going to collect them out of. The trap is actually already covered in barnacle larvae. The whole thing is covered in barnacle larvae, and we had a huge barnacle set the last week, and that barnacle set actually really choked up our collection for 2 pulls of the trap. It really choked up the collection. It was just, everything was loaded with these tiny barnacle, which are a crustacean. And so they have a free swimming form before they settle down on the bottom. Ooh, got a nice big bristle worm there. Oh, there's been a new set of something that just loaded the trap. Wow. What is that? Again, it looks like mud, but those are all creatures. Unfortunately, when we get back a set, it tends to block off the oxygen to some of the fish. And so we've got a bit of mortality in what looked to be small herring, just a couple though. It's funny because the last day I did it, the trap was really clear of sediments or sediment-looking stuff.
And that was only 2 days ago.
Every day is different out here as the creatures react to the moon and to water temperature and to salinity. Okay, I'm gonna rinse the trap now. Oh, yeah, interesting. Really heavy, fishy smell.
So Mike, just from what you can see by the naked eye, can you see if there's any evidence of crab larvae in here?
We do have a couple little megalope that are just trying to get out of that mass of water. And that's one there. But the first thing I have to do before I actually do any of this is take a picture of our overall set. So what else is in here? We have 1, 2, 3, 4 large bristle worms. But we do have at least one crab megalope that we're going to examine later. But right now I need to take a picture.
Oh. Different colored things too.
Yeah.
I see something that's pinky orangey. And
yeah.
And there's a silver something. And then something that's a beautiful aquamarine green.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this aquamarine green was probably a herring.
Oh.
A baby herring.
Oh,
these
yeah.
guys here are hooded shrimp. Hooded shrimp. But look. Now that we've got it backlit against the teaspoon, you can see that this, what looks to be sediment, is actually coming up and swimming, and it's made up of orange and brown particles, which we're going to look at underneath the magnifying glass. Cool, eh? I guess it could be phytoplankton. Not if it's moving like that. Dungeness crab megalope, like I've mentioned, we haven't seen any yet this year, and they are the largest of the megalope. We are getting some crab megalope. Thus far, they're not Dungeness crab. What surprised me is a lot of them have been identified as being black clawed megalope. But I'm not seeing any Dungeness crab yet. We're nothing big enough to be a Dungeness crab.
Because they're the largest.
They're the biggest. And their carapace is about, it ranges between 2 to 3 millimeter or even up to 4.5 millimeters in width. So we're not seeing anything of that magnitude yet.
Greg Osoba, Cortez Island.
Hey, I'm Anastasia Avakumova in beautiful British Columbia. Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI and get all our stories on canada-info.ca.
So this ends this edition of Viewpoints presented by the Community Radio Fund of Canada in collaboration with campus and community radios across the country. Thanks to our journalists Taylor McClure, Greg Osoba, Sarah Gouda, and their guests, to Maureen McEwen, our national coordinator, and to the artists who help us out with their music. I'm Boris Chassin. Thanks for being with us. Stay tuned to your local radio station. Goodbye.